Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is Thursday, August 2nd, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we have Nick Bryan, author of The Franklin Scandal. He joins me for a discussion of pedophilia in politics. This is a topic I've wanted to talk with you about for a long time. Very important what's going on, and I think the story of the Franklin Scandal is the perfect story to use to explore that topic. So I'm very, very delighted Nick could join us. Our theme tonight is having the future. This was a week when, whether it was in Cincinnati where I've been staying or all across the world as you watch the stories, the world seemed to break up between people who were eager to deal with reality and build the future and people who are grumpy about things, how things are turning out, which is differently than we were all promised. While I appreciate there's a lot to be grumpy about, the reality is that personal power comes from taking responsibility, and what every one of us needs to deal with our situations individually or collectively or to serve others is to gather power. And I was appalled this week at the amount of criticism that's being targeted at just about every business leader or government official and the amount of attention paid by the media in embroiling people in what I call divide and conquer issues. So the big one is always men versus women. Then there's blacks versus whites and immigrants versus non-immigrants, gay versus heterosexual, progressives versus conservatives, and on and on. And between the negativity and the divide and conquer, there was an enormous amount of people who were moving away from anything that would give them power or just, you know, losing power, and it was kind of sad to see. And it makes it very difficult. Anybody who's in a legitimate line management position, and not everybody in those positions, thank God, is corrupt, it makes it very difficult and dangerous to keep getting things done, because when you're on the line, it's impossible to get everything right. It's impossible to be perfect. You know, you're shooting for the odds. Six Sigma, which is one of the highest standards of quality control, is six flaws per million parts. But if everybody's playing gotcha, there's still six flaws. And when I worked at HUD, we used to say that an auditor was a person who bayoneted the wounds. And it, over the last week, it kind of looked like everybody in society was bayoneting the wounds. And we have to be careful because we want to bring transparency to truthfully what's wrong, but we also don't want to destroy that which is healthy. So this kind of attitude can destroy the economy. And I found myself, oddly enough, on Monday night on Coast to Coast defending General Motors, which had taken a hit piece from Fox News. Fox News said it was a scandal that General Motors was lending predominantly to people who are not prime credits. I don't think that's a scandal. I think it's a scandal that everybody in America has become not a prime credit. That's the scandal I prefer to talk about. And, of course, as I said, on the last Soleri report, if you look at the coverage over LIBOR, the alternative media has not bothered to get the facts or the evidence or to understand the basic financial concepts. They're just attacking everybody for being corrupt. And that's a danger because the last thing we want to do is become a tool of the very people who've engineered the coup d'etat in the first place if we're just a mob killing the people they're ready to engineer out. Speaking of taking responsibility, we'll be talking again, as I said, to a man tonight who's done a masterful job of doing so in the service of children and people everywhere. And that's Nick Bryan, who's written a book that really is a very courageous and important act. It's called The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal. And you're going to hear a lot more about it tonight. I think you're going to find it very instructive. Money and markets, the lead story this week around the world, as I predicted in the first quarter, in our annual wrap-up in January, is weird weather. We see reports across the United States and in many other places of drought, and what this is going to do to food and water supplies and debates about what's causing it. But that story is buried behind lots and lots of stories on the financial side of the balance sheet, full of issues about debt and bank balance and complex financial concepts and terms. But if you read through it and go back to what's really hurting the economy, if anything, it's the weather. Now, one of the things you saw pick up as this happens was more debates about the cause and effect of what's causing the weather problems. And they continue, unfortunately, to leave out discussion of chemtrails. And my attitude is until you're going to integrate chemtrails into your discussion and explain how that fits in, I'm going to have a hard time taking you seriously, whatever your point of view and conclusion is. up on the blog earlier this week, it's off the homepage now, I've had it up twice, is a major conference being organized in Los Angeles later this month called Consciousness and Chemtrails. It will broadcast through the web, so you can sign up for a reasonably low amount of money and watch it through the web. You don't have to go all the way to Los Angeles. And they're literally bringing Clifford Carnicom, Will Thomas, and all the people who've done the best coverage of this topic. So I think it's going to be very interesting in terms of aggregating the knowledge about this topic and disseminating it. But quietly, as all this is going on, you're seeing a lot of smart money moving in and buying up quality farmland and water, literally worldwide. In the Eurozone and in America, we saw markets fall today as the heads of the ECB and Federal Reserve gave more words instead of announcements of bond purchases or other infusions of fresh funds. It was, you know, it's been kind of a tease with empty words finally coming out today. My guess is they're simply letting more air out of the balloon. The Fed's likely to engage in more quantitative easing in a presidential election year, but if they let more air out of the balloon when the quantitative easing comes, the pop is going to be that much greater. So it's going to be interesting to see when they finally do so. Watching the Romney campaign twist in the wind for the last 2 weeks, and certainly a disastrous trip abroad in London and then Europe for Romney, there's no signal whatsoever that Romney did get any kind of anointing at the Bohemian Grove. And that means to me there's a greater chance the Fed is going to do whatever it has to do to maintain the markets through the election at least. Story up on the blog about the EU criminalizing commodity pricing manipulation and the CFTC here moving to enforce against an MF global trader for manipulation of palladium and platinum prices. That has to make me laugh because as a matter of national policy, we've been manipulating precious metals prices very significantly for more than a decade. So, you know, moving after an MF global trader now that that firm is shut down on sort of a sideshow, it tells you that, if anything, they're desperate for something to make it look like they are enforcing. But it brings up the question that we've talked about constantly when we discuss the oil card, which is how do you, if managing commodity prices as a tool of national security and national economic policy in a global competition is really a decision of state, how can you possibly enforce against people for doing it? That raises a multiple personality disorder that we have yet to address as sort of a society. In Asia, continuing announcements of stimulus plans from China, that's important because the slowing in Asia is contributing mightily to a slowdown in the global economy. That's in part coming from Europe because China exports about 50% into the European Union. So this slowing is big, and the effort to get China doing, or Chinese consumers to replace a little bit of the load or China stimulus and infrastructure programs is important. And so everybody's watching to see how much stimulus and how much that will sort of slow down the slowing down. China is tied in the Olympics with the U.S. for gold medals. We seem to have put geopolitics aside for a week, and we're just competing over medals. But China and U.S. have 18 each, with U.S. now pulling ahead today with 37 total to 34 total for China. Meantime, India has had the mother of all blackouts, hundreds of millions of people without power, and that can certainly help to slow down one of the fastest-growing economies as well. The Middle East is as fractious as ever. With Putin back in power, it means Russia's feistier than ever, and that's going to make the Middle East a feistier locale, not to mention reports now out of Pravda that Putin is sending nuclear missiles to Cuba. Let's see if that's confirmed, but given that we have missiles moving closer on the rim to Russia, it wouldn't surprise me if Putin tries something like that. The U.S. economy, jobs, 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 is front and center again as the economy slows in a presidential election year. The latest Gallup poll shows the jobs as the issue first on voters' mind. Interestingly enough, number two is government corruption, which is good because there's a direct link between that corruption and the fact what's happening to the income side of households. Propaganda over budgets is full of disinformation, as I said last month. It's continually, the propaganda is continually presenting the problem as being there's no money, which means the solution is we have to cut back taxpayers and labor. Retirees have spent a lifetime investing cash into the system, and frankly, the system has other uses for the cash. It wants to build global empire. It doesn't want the money coming back. So now's the time to to sort of abrogate the deal or slow it down and slow it down and slow it down. The theory that there is no money is not true. That's not to say, however, that there aren't some very hard truths that need to be faced and things need to be changed. There are a whole lot of things, if you look at the real truth, that many, many people do not want to hear, such as the fact that 50% or more of households are financially dependent directly or indirectly on government spending, a vast majority of it which encourages negative productivity. Part of the other thing is that a false picture leads to false solutions, like slashing pension benefits, cutting health care, extending retirement age. And it's interesting to see the proposals. There's a story about CEOs with proposals on Social Security in the budget. And those proposals include extending the retirement age, which is a real problem, because if there are no jobs, how's that supposed to work? Are we supposed to generate more income and work longer if there are no jobs? This all dovetails with the health care rules. There's a story in the New York Times up on the blog about what the health care rules are doing to, or the new health care plan is doing to small business. Perfect example is fast food restaurants. I've talked to before about the danger that fast food restaurants will move to robotics, and I think if you look at the economics of what the fast food, what healthcare is doing to a lot of the fast food franchises and small business owners, it's just going to put the pressure on to go that way even more. One of the positives coming out of this, Jeb Bush, governor of Florida, son of George H.W. Bush, once said that there's no constituency for fiscal responsibility. We're starting to see little hints, little seeds of life that may be changing. A couple stories I put up on the blog about people diving in and looking at the consolidated annual financial reports. There's stories percolating around the internet on participatory budgeting, which is something that started in Latin America. As people started to dig in and say, well, wait a minute, where is the money? Let's find the money. And that includes the story of an effort by the state parks in California to do numerous sort of privatization things because there was no money. Everybody dug in and found over $50 million sitting in a reserve account. It turned out there was money. You're hearing lots of noise about defense cuts. Don't believe it. The global empire build-out is going to continue to be protected. But I think that's all part of the propaganda on the theory that is there no money. We saw one article, and it's up on the jobs, about companies having trouble finding people with the right skills and there being an imbalance between people looking for jobs and the kind of jobs that companies want to fill. There is no doubt, and this is a major issue over the student loan issue, that we're watching a mismatch between the curriculums that schools are providing and encouraging kids to get an education in, and the skill sets that companies and other employers are looking for. And that's one thing you want to think a lot about if you're headed into college or you've got kids or grandkids headed into college. In financial markets, we saw Bill Gross, Dr. Doom, predict the end of the cult of equity markets. And the markets did back off, including precious metals, with the ECB and Fed non-announcements today. Lots to talk about next week with Franklin. The biggest concern up on the front of the blog, the garbage index is way down. It's diving the way it did in 2008, and that is a real, very significant but rarely looked at indicator, and I would encourage you to take a look at that chart. Finally, in food and health, we have a great video, if you get a chance to see it, up on the blog from Mumbai. Genetically modified mushrooms that snuck out of a lab apparently were stolen, are turning into mushrooms literally the size of Volkswagens in the slums of Mumbai, and they produce electricity. It's a very interesting use of food. Also, a great story from an FDA whistleblower and a very interesting video on psychopaths that is Peter Coyote is the narrator, and it's quite fascinating. Wild cards, we have MSNBC showing pictures of a UFO flying over the Olympic Open ceremonies in London. And you kind of wonder what the mainstream press is up to when they do things like that. Surprisingly, tonight we have no questions in Ask Catherine. I couldn't believe it, given the topic. But that's fine because we certainly have plenty to talk about. And you won't be surprised to hear that our hero of the evening is Nick Bryant, the author and and researcher and reporter that we're going to be talking to tonight. There is nothing harder than doing the kind of hard, good, old-fashioned investigatory research and writing that Nick has done in the Franklin scandal. And there's nothing when it comes to digging into a topic like this that is more powerful than that kind of investigative journalism done to the kind of standard that Nick has done it to. And I assure you, with a story like this, it takes a great amount of courage. It takes a great amount of fearlessness. It takes a great amount of hard work and just not giving up. You need a stubborn streak to get this done, and he's done it and written a remarkable book. And we should all be very grateful, because it's an incredible example of the power of transparency to heal a lot of wounds and bring real change. So with that, let me turn to the interview and start first with a little bit of an introduction about why I wanted to have Nick join us and why I wanted to talk about this topic. For those of you who've been subscribers for many years, you know that as different people predict the collapse of the economy, I am constantly saying, no, it's not going to collapse, it's going to slow burn. And the reason is because I've spent a great deal of time in my life, whether working inside the system or outside the system, studying it, understanding how the financial markets and businesses and covert industries are engineered. How can we have significant mortgage fraud on the trillion-dollar scale in this country, despite the fact that we have courts, we have enforcement agencies, we have the rule of law. And one of the things that's key to understanding the control in the system is to understand control files. And control files come back to many different things, but they come back to systems of personnel benefits and systems of entrapment and corruption and control that is very much tied up with sex and sexual favors. I'm constantly looking for ways to help you understand the existence of the control file system that's operating. And in fact, I put up on the blog, a little post I wrote this week in anticipation of the conversation about control files, and you can read it there. But it's hard for people to fathom how these kind of covert industries and this kind of financial fraud is engineered. And I think understanding, taking a step back and understanding pedophilia and what has happened in this country with pedophilia can then be a very important background to understanding how control was engineered. So that's the backdrop on why I would very much like to have Nick on the show and have this conversation. So without further ado, let me introduce to you Nick Bryant, author of The Franklin Scandal, A Story of Power Brokers, Child Abuse, and Betrayal. Nick, are you with us?
I'm with you, Catherine.
Well, thank you very much for doing this. We have there's so much to cover, but let's just start with how in the world did you come to know about the Franklin Scandal and decide that you were going to write a book about it?
Well, it was kind of a circuitous path for me. I was originally researching an article on the occult for a mainstream magazine, and I came across a U.S. Customs report about a group called the Finders that was seemingly trafficking children, and they were busted in Florida, and the U.S. Customs Service was called in because there was evidence of child pornography. And the Finders were out of Washington, D.C. So you ultimately had immediately a three law enforcement entity investigation of the Finders for transporting children across state lines for moral purposes, kidnapping, and also child pornography. So you had the Tallahassee Police, you had the Washington, D.C. Metro Police, and also you had the U.S. Customs. And they served search warrants on the Finders' warehouses in Washington, D.C., and they came across a cache of really horrific pictures involving children and a number of other illicit items. And the CIA ultimately quashed the entire investigation into the finders. And the two finders that were transporting the six children originally had a hefty bail and were charged with multiple counts of child abuse, and all their child abuse charges were dropped. And then the children were given back to the cult. And I was just, when I came across that U.S. Customs report, which is in the back of my book, I was just stunned. I was, first of all, the CIA shouldn't have any kind of power whatsoever domestically in the United States. And what are they doing coming to the rescue of some people that are seemingly doing some very nefarious things to children? So I tried to dig into the finders to the best of my ability, and I just hit a brick wall. I mean, I just could not go further. No one was willing to talk. I found a number of people that were affiliated with the finders, but no one would talk. And then I came across something that was similar. It was on the internet, a story about an interstate pedophile network run out of Omaha, Nebraska, using Boys Town students that was also affiliated with the CIA. And I went to Nebraska. When I went to Nebraska, there was enough information that I thought that something had gone down in Nebraska involving child abuse, but I didn't think that it was interstate, and I certainly didn't think that powerful people, at least on the national level, were involved. I'm skeptical by nature, but I always try to keep an open mind. And when I arrived in Nebraska, I found some documentation that showed a lot of kids had been abused. I found some documentation that showed that they'd been transported across state lines. Actually, they'd been flown. And then I talked to some people that had been affiliated with this pedophile network, and they all struck me as being honest. So I believed that I was onto something. And then I also had a death threat, too. And death threats generally tell a journalist that they're on the right track. Now, whether or not the journalist pursues it, I mean, that's a question of whether he's either a little crazy or a little brave or maybe both. But once I got the death threat, I kind of knew that I was on the right track.
Well, the book you're talking about, I assume that you read, was John DeCamp's The Franklin Cover-Up?
Yes, yes. And I thought that he made a fairly good argument for some kind of pedophile ring inside of Nebraska, but I didn't think that he'd made a very good argument for anything outside of Nebraska. And I watched Conspiracy of Silence, which was a documentary made about this. And again, I thought that they made a fairly strong argument for some kind of pedophile ring in Nebraska, but I didn't think that that documentary made a solid argument for a pedophile network that was coast to coast. Once I started digging into it, and I started, I eventually managed to, there were two grand juries in Nebraska that were used to cover up this pedophile network, and there was also a grand jury in Washington, D.C. that was used to cover up this pedophile network. Now, grand jury documentation and testimony are always sealed, but I managed to get most of the sealed exhibits and most of the sealed testimony from one of the grand juries. And at that point, I had a list of well over 60 victims and a lot of leads to follow. So it was just a matter of finding these victims. And a lot of these victims were taken out of Boys Town, and a number of them were taken out of the foster care system and other institutions. So basically, they were the perfect children to prey upon. They were from lower socioeconomic families, dysfunctional families, fragmented families that found themselves institutionalized. So they really had no one looking over them other than perhaps corrupt institutions. So these kids were very difficult to find because they were turned into drugs and repeatedly molested at a very young age. The youngest victim I talked to was 11 years old. His name is Nikolai Kamen. He was taken out of Boys Town. And by the time they hit 17 or 18, they've lost what the pedophiles consider their marketability. So basically you're left with a kid that has been that never really had a chance. They're from a very difficult background. They've been repeatedly molested. They've been turned on to drugs. So generally, you're left with someone in their late adolescence, early adulthood, who's a drug addict and who has to commit felonies to support their habit. And ultimately, they end up in prison and thereby compromise their own credibility. So what I had to do was find as many victims as I possibly could to corroborate these stories. And then I also went back and I showed how corrupt the grand jury was, or at least one of the grand juries. One of the state grand jury declared that this pedophile network that I proved existed was actually a quote-unquote carefully crafted hoax. And I went, and one of the chapters in the book is solely dedicated to this grand jury, but because I had the grand jury testimony, I could actually bring the reader into a grand jury. And that's, I don't, as far as I know, that has never happened before, where a writer has been able to bring a reader into a grand jury. Of course, what I did was illegal, publishing grand jury testimony. But I felt that the state and federal authorities' cover-up of child abuse was such an egregious miscarriage of justice that I had no problem publishing sealed grand jury testimony. And to this day, I mean, the government could arrest me for that, but the government does not want to publicize my book, so they refuse to arrest me. It's kind of an interesting conundrum.
One of the things I thought was the most powerful about your book was you have the Nebraska legislature doing investigation, digging things out. Then you have John DeCamp doing it. But then you come in as a new party, fresh, not from Nebraska, and you basically review everything in a very thorough way again and essentially corroborate the gist of what they're saying. And I think having that a second major independent investigation, if you will, that basically comes at it without any connections to those parties and corroborates is very, very powerful.
Yes, and I wanted to write the Franklin scandal, and it took me 7 years to write that book. I made 13 trips to Nebraska, 12 trips after the death threat, and I made a number of trips down the eastern seaboard, too. And I drove all around the Midwest looking for victims. I really wanted to put the Franklin scandal together in such a way that it would be infallible, that people would read it and it would provide incontrovertible proof that there was this interstate pedophile network that flew children from coast to coast and pandered them to the rich and powerful. And it was also covered up by state and federal authorities, mostly the Department of Justice and the FBI. And that's very difficult for a lot of Americans to get their mind around, that the Department of Justice and the FBI would cover up an interstate pedophile network. But this particular pedophile network was hooked up to some of the most powerful people in the United States. And because of garnering the sealed exhibits, I have over 200 of the network's flight receipts. And most of those flight receipts go to Washington, D.C., and in Washington, D.C., there was a party house that was owned by a Washington, D.C. power broker named Craig Spence. And in that party house was two-way mirrors and audiovisual recording equipment. So anybody that partied there would ultimately become compromised or blackmailed.
Well, why don't we just step back to make sure that everybody understands the story? It came out of Omaha, Nebraska. There was an SNL. Why don't you start with what the name Franklin comes from? Who was it, and what happened?
Franklin was a credit union for lower socioeconomic people in northern Omaha, which is a depressed part of the city of Omaha, northern Omaha. And it was run by a Republican big shot named Lawrence E. King. Lawrence E. King had connections to the Reagan administration and also to the Bush 1 administration. He was a good friend of Jack Kemp and Samuel Pierce, who was later disgraced as the head of HUD. But King had all kinds of connections to the power elite within the United States of America and certainly within Washington, D.C. And this was a lower socioeconomic credit union, and it should have, in the books, it had $2.5 million. But actually, the king had looted it for around $40 million. But he'd managed to stave off audits for 4 years. And finally, the feds came in shortly after George Herbert Walker Bush was elected president and shut it down. And they declared that $40 million was missing. So at that point, the Nebraska Senate was meeting, and they, a number of senators had seen this in the, with the SNLs in Nebraska, and they looked at the Franklin Credit Union, and they saw $40 million that were missing. And ultimately, they formed a subcommittee to investigate initially just the financial crimes of Lawrence E. King. And then, after the subcommittee had formed to investigate the financial crimes of Lawrence E. King, social service personnel came to the senators because they had reports that King had been flying children from coast to coast and pandering them to the rich and powerful. And these are very high-ranking social service personnel in Nebraska. And they went to both state and federal law enforcement, and they told state and federal law enforcement that someone needs to look into Lawrence King because we believe that he is flying children around the country and pandering them to the rich and powerful. But the social service personnel were just simply ignored by state and federal authorities. So when this Nebraska subcommittee formed, these social services personnel went to the senators and said, the financial crimes is only one aspect of the crimes of Lawrence E. King. He's an interstate pedophilic pimp, and he's been transferring kids around, and we've got documentation, solid documentation on it. So at that point, the senators started to look at King's exploitation of children, too. And that's when things got very, very rough for them.
And what caused the, because at one point the story really did break. And I know because Paul Rodriguez, who I later got to know well, who in fact wrote a story about my litigation, broke some of it in the Washington Times. So
well,
there was
the Washington Times. There were two individuals that ran this interstate pedophile network. One was Lawrence E. King of Omaha, Nebraska, and the other one was Craig Spence of Washington, D.C. And as I said earlier, a lot of the kids would be taken to parties at Spence's house. That was for audiovisual blackmail. Rodriguez broke the Washington, D.C. side of the story with Craig Spence. But the pedophile network that was being run by Lawrence E. King never found its way into the Washington Times.
Ah, okay. Okay.
I was able to corroborate the partnership of King and Spence. I ultimately found six individuals that corroborated the partnership of King and Spence. And one of them was actually a police officer, too.
Well, you know, I had a terrible altercation with Kemp, which I've described on the I posted the blog, and I linked to the blog post about our interview tonight, where he kept trying to order me to do a criminally illegal award of subsidy, and I kept saying, Jack, look, there's 100% chance we will get caught. We can't do this. And I kept trying to talk him out of it, and I've never, Nick, seen a man as afraid as he was. He was in a state of complete terror, and I kept saying, we can't do this. We will get caught. You know, we can't. He said, I don't care. Just do it. Do it. And I've seen people facing death. He was much more terrified than that. And I didn't realize it until many years later, but it was literally, as far as I can tell, the very week that Rodriguez came out with the story with the Washington Times headline of kids at the White House. So, you know, that
well,
doesn't
actually,
necessarily.
That story was about prostitutes, adult prostitutes being taken, given a midnight tour of the White House.
Right.
And, yes, Jack Kemp had a number of connections to Lawrence E. King. And it was rumored that Jack Kemp was homosexual back in the days when he played for the Los Angeles Rams. when he was a professional quarterback. Or maybe it was the Buffalo Bills. Yeah, it was the Buffalo Bills. He was a professional quarterback. And he also served on Reagan's staff when Reagan was governor. And there were a number of rumors that Jack Kemp was, in fact, homosexual. And actually, he was asked on the Today Show whether or not he was homosexual. And in the Franklin scandal, I show that there are a number of links between Jack Kemp and Lawrence E. King.
Well, it was really funny. I had five deputies, and one of them was considered to be very politically savvy. And during this sort of, you know, please make the illegal award thing, he pulled me aside and he said, look, this situation is very, very, he was considered very closely connected to the sort of inside Republican Party in Washington. He said, this situation is very, very dangerous. You have to be very careful. And he was really, you could tell he was very concerned. And I said, oh, come on, Jim. I said, he said, you know, there are very, very bad rumors about Kemp. And I said, oh, well, everybody knows about the homosexual rumors. That's all been vetted. Nobody cares about that. And he said, oh, no, this is much, much worse. And I said, oh, right, you're going to tell me that Kemp's sleeping with sheep. And he grabbed me and he said, no, this is much, much worse. And I assumed what he meant was pedophilia, but, you know, I never asked him. And that's when I said, okay, I understand how dangerous this is. But I didn't connect it to the headline. I didn't know about the Franklin cover-up story, and I didn't know about the Craig Spence headlines until many, you know, more than a decade later when I started to research this. So,
well, you know, the thing about it is Paul Rodriguez and company at the Washington Times did amazing reporting on Craig Spence. I mean, really, truly amazing reporting. That would ultimately be nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. But all their reporting was quashed by the Washington Post and the New York Times. The Washington Post primarily ganged up on the Washington Times, and the New York Times and L.A. Times also gave the Washington Post a helping hand and just kind of kicked them to the curb. And in my reporting in the Franklin scandal, I show that the Washington Post really did play an integral role and covering up the pedophilic and blackmail activities of Craig Spence.
Right. Well, my personal experience with the Washington Post is I've seen them do that on several occasions with major stories like this, and the New York Times, too. And I think one of the reasons I would really encourage people here to read your book is it shows you, in the case of both the Department of Justice and enforcement, or in the major media, the extent to which the system protects the system on these situations. And I think
the markers were called in. Actually, CBS also worked on covering this up, too, and basically making sure that a young woman who wouldn't recant her abuse was given 9 to 15 years for perjury. There were two kids that refused to recant their abuse in the Franklin Network. I mean, the FBI came in, and they got heavy with all these kids. And a lot of the kids just fled. I mean, if you're a kid that is from a lower socioeconomic background and a dysfunctional family, and you've been turned on to drugs at a very young age and repeatedly molested, and then the FBI comes to you, the guy's wearing the jackets and the sunglasses, and they say, we don't want you to talk about this. We want you to leave town. I mean, if you're one of those kids, you get out of town. And but there were two kids that withstood the FBI's pressure cooker and the state law enforcement's pressure cooker. One was Paul Benassi, and one was Alicia Owen. And Paul was indicted by the state grand jury on 3 counts of perjury, and Alicia was indicted on 8 counts of perjury. And those counts of perjury carried 20-year maximum. So for refusing to recant their abuse, Paul was looking at 60 years, and Alicia was looking at 160 years. And then a federal grand jury that was covering up Franklin to make sure that they had a backstop also indicted Alicia on 8 counts of perjury. So this young girl, this 21-year-old girl who had been molested since early adolescence, was looking at approximately 300 years in prison for refusing to recant her abuse. And
a little bit like the Spanish Inquisition, isn't it?
Oh, very much. In her trial, I really document the malfeasance in her trial. And actually, I just have the utmost respect for Alicia Owen. I mean, that kid was just abused horrifically. And she stood up to the feds. She stood up to the state. She was looking at 300 years. And I really show what a kangaroo court her trial was, how corrupt her trial was. And she had a lawyer that really tried to fight for her, but they just could not overcome the corruption. And ultimately, there was a lot of jury manipulation, too. And that's where CBS's 48 Hours came in and basically called her a perjurer. And all her jurors watched this episode of 48 Hours. So here you have Dan Rather in New York City, the big time, CBS, saying that this kid is a perjurer who's on trial. I mean, and they knew that she was on trial. I mean, the reporter of the CBS 48 Hours segment discussed Alicia being on trial, but she refused to back down. She was ultimately sentenced between 9 and 15 years for perjury. I believe it's the longest, that Alicia's trial was the longest criminal trial in Nebraska history. And it wasn't for treason, it wasn't for murder, but it was a kid who refused to recant her abuse. And ultimately, she was sentenced between 9 and 15 years for perjury, and she had to spend 2 years in solitary. And her little brother, who was 17 years old, I demonstrated in my book, committed suicide under very suspicious circumstances. So Alicia really took just an unbelievable beating, and very much, I mean, Alicia is really a portrait in courage, and I've got nothing but respect for her, the way that she stood up against the federal government, and actually the state government, too.
One of the reasons I get so angry when people say, why isn't anyone doing anything? You know, because you get these stories of people who just do the most amazingly moral things under impossible situations, and this story is certainly one of them, of those two kids.
Alicia's story in Hollywood, and no one is willing to touch it. That's the thing. I mean, I live in New York City. I live in the epicenter of journalism in the world, and I have a number of friends who are producers for people who have television shows who are supposedly child advocates, and nobody will touch my book. I found it almost impossible to get this book published, even after I'd assembled unbelievable amounts of evidence and documentation and corroboration. Trinday was really the only publisher in the country that would touch this book. But the people at Trinday knew that the people that I was going after were just so dirty that they could not withstand the discovery process. Because I talked to a publisher previously, and he wasn't concerned about child abuse. He was concerned about libel. And we haven't been sued. And ultimately, although I published sealed grand jury testimony, I have not been arrested. So this is a book that the government would like to see, that the government would really like to see go gently into that good night.
Well, tell us that. So we've talked about what happened. We've talked about the extent to which it reached into the highest levels of political power. We've talked about the implications to media enforcement of such a thing happening, what it means as to their corruption. What are the implications to politics, to business, to investment, to culture? What does this say about the governance system under which we're operating?
Well, I think that had this story been broken open, I mean, this story had to be covered up at all costs. In my book, there's two or three mysterious deaths every chapter. Alicia's brother is not the only one that dies of a mysterious suicide. There's also a plane that disintegrates in midair, killing the Nebraska Senate investigator. There's bodies strewn all over the Franklin scandal. I believe that this had to be covered up at all costs. If the American people were aware that the checks and balances in their system, the democratic system, was blackmail instead of the executive, the legislative, and the Supreme Court, there would be tremendous outrage. And also that if the American public knew that children were being used to compromise politicians, I think that that would have caused just a tremendous amount of outrage. I think that Bush 1's presidency would have been very much jeopardized had this story been blown wide open, and consequently the Bush dynasty would have been jeopardized. So there were a number of reasons why this had to be covered up, and that's why there were three corrupted grand juries. Now, I don't know if your reader or your listeners really understand the grand jury system, but it can be a very flawed, corrupt system. When people think the sealed indictment came down from a grand jury, it's like Moses coming down from the mountain with the Ten Commandments, but that's not the case. Grand jurors are simply good citizens that have shown up for jury duty, and they've been funneled into a grand jury. And the grand jury system is not adversarial. A special prosecutor is chosen, and he decides what evidence is shown to the grand jurors. So special prosecutors are in a very powerful position to show whatever they want to the grand jurors, and everything is sealed. So no one's going to be able to know if this special prosecutor hijacked the grand jury or didn't hijack the grand jury, because everything is sealed. So he chooses the witnesses that are called and the evidence that is shown to the grand jurors. And a justice in New York State once quipped that special prosecutors have so much power over a grand jury that they could get a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. And that's very, very true. So that's one of the problems with this story, is that you've got three hijacked grand juries that should have gone for truth and should have exposed this pedophile network, but ultimately covered it up. It's a very sad commentary on the American judiciary.
Well, Nick, what can people do and let's start with our own families. If I'm a parent or a grandparent, how do I make sure my children are safe? We're talking about a world where, there are predators running around, and all the institutions and people who are supposed to be protecting those children, may be compromised. How do we function with that?
Well, I think the victims' right movement was given, unfortunately, a big boost by Jerry Sandusky, because that demonstrated absolutely that predators prey on children. And although a number of people are cognizant of these predators, they keep their mouths shut because of the reputations and prestige that could be affected. And for parents that have children, they should be very cautious about who they choose or who spends time with their children. And they have to be very wary. It's something that you've got to be very vigilant about. And is this person pressuring the parents to take the kid on, like, field trips? I mean, there's been a number of stories about molestation by scoutmasters that have come out in recent years, and also by Catholic priests. So, but it's not only the Boy Scouts of America, and it's not only the Catholic Church. There are predators amongst us that are affiliated with secular institutions like the Second Mile Foundation. So, parents have to be wary of grown men that want to spend inordinate amounts of time with their children. And also, they have to be wary of these types of individuals providing gifts to their children, too. And I know it's a fine line, because there are a lot of good people out there that like to that give children gifts and are good to children, but parents have to be wary of these telltale signs.
Now, Conspiracy of Silence, tell us about, I chose that for the Let's Go to the Movie, because it does have a lot of good interviews and a lot of good footage about the Franklin scandal story. How did Conspiracy of Silence come to be made?
Tim Tate had read John DeCamp's book. Tim Tate was a producer for Yorkshire Television, which is in the United Kingdom. And he had read John DeCamp's book, and he made a trip to Nebraska to look into it. And he looked at DeCamp's documentation, and he talked to some people, kind of like what I did. And he concluded that there was something that went down. And ultimately, a crew from the UK ventured to Nebraska and Washington, D.C., and they did get some good interviews. And it was going to be shown on Discovery Tuesdays, which is the Discovery Channel in the United Kingdom has a Tuesday night slot, or used to have a Tuesday night slot, where new documentaries would be shown. And it was supposed to be shown on Discovery, what was called Discovery Tuesdays. And some executives at the Discovery Channel quashed the documentary. There is a lot of innuendo about why and how that documentary got quashed, but I talked to both the producer and the director, and that's what they told me. There's a lot of innuendo about Franklin that's very dramatic, but that's basically the nuts and bolts. There was an executive at the Discovery Channel that quashed the project.
What year was that? Do you remember?
That was it was going to be shown in
1994. And it finally made its way up on the internet. I don't quite know when, but I think it's available for free.
The best copy of Conspiracy of Silence is actually on my website, franklinscandal.com, and it has scenes in it that the other Conspiracy of Silences that are floating around the internet don't have. And
it's got all that footage at the end?
Well, there's a lot of different footage that mine has that the other Conspiracy of Silence that's floating around the internet doesn't have. And actually, it's a higher quality version, too.
There's one interview. I've always been fascinated by Bill Colby's role in the Franklin story and whether that had any implications for what happened to him. But there's one interview where someone in the long version with the footage at the end is talking about Colby and his role, which I found absolutely fascinating. And I really enjoyed watching
it. I get into Bill Colby's death. William Colby was the former director of the CIA, and I get into his death in the Franklin scandal a little bit. And he was actually, what happened was when the Franklin Committee formed and the social service personnel came to the senators and said that Lawrence E. King is running an interstate pedophile network, they were looking for an investigator for the subcommittee to investigate these child abuse allegations. And they interviewed William Colby to be the investigator. And ultimately, they decided the investigator or the counsel to the subcommittee, but ultimately they decided that he had too much baggage. The senators had heard rumors that Lawrence E. King might be affiliated to the CIA, and they were worried that Bill Colby, once CIA, always CIA. So they ultimately shot down his appointment as a special investigator for the subcommittee. But later on, the investigator that they ultimately hired was Gary Caradore, and he found a number of King's victims, and he videotaped four of them, and a couple others had come forward previously with social services. And he was an amazing investigator, and in my book, I talk about how he was harassed by the FBI and how his phones were tapped, his house was broken into. Gary Caradore was an amazing investigator, but he found himself basically taking on the federal government when he tried to expose this pedophile network. And in my book, I have five corroborations that he received illicit pictures in Chicago of people that were involved, adults and children that were involved in this pedophile network that would have blown the thing wide open and probably had a seismic ripple effect all the way to Washington, D.C. And after he acquired these pictures, his plane mysteriously broke up over Lee County, Illinois, and he was killed. So after Gary Tiradori was killed, the committee hired William Colby to look into Gary Tiradori's death. Now, I've got some things. William Colby said off record that to four people that I talked to that Gary Tiradori was in fact murdered, but he would never state it publicly. So I don't really know whether or not William Colby's enigmatic death is related to Franklin or not, because
right.
he was unwilling to state publicly that Gary Tiradori had been murdered.
Right, right. It was a little bit later, I think, in terms of timing. Well, let me ask you a personal question. How this has been an extraordinary investment of time and a real act of courage on your part to publish this book and then to shepherd it through the, getting this message across. How has this experience changed you?
Well, one cannot be unaffected by this, for sure. I have crawled into the darkest crevice of humanity and looked for the truth. And it certainly affected my outlook on life. Before I stumbled into the Franklin scandal, I think I was a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. I mean, I still kind of am, relatively speaking, but it's certainly affected me. I've written a lot on children's issues before I wrote the Franklin scandal. I'd had papers published in various academic journals about the problems facing disadvantaged children in America. And I also wrote a book about the problems facing disadvantaged children in America. So I'm very much a child's rights advocate. And then to see that the government, or I should say a very corrupt subgenus of the government, covered up this massive child pandering network, I mean, not only was it shocking to me, but it really broke my heart that the government would be facilitating wholesale child abuse. I mean, it broke my heart, but at the same time, I felt that the previous renditions of it hadn't been told correctly, and I really wanted to tell this story in a way that would make it infallible to the reader who read the book, that there was in fact an interstate pedophile network, and it was covered up by the FBI, the Department of Justice, and in Washington, D.C. by the Secret Service.
Well, I want you to know you absolutely achieved your purpose, because, any chance that it might be a hoax was complete. When I sat down and I spent a weekend, that was a while ago, reading your book, and, when I put it down, I realized, that you had just nailed it, and that there was no chance that the story wasn't true. And so if it's any solace, you absolutely hit the ball out of the park. Anyway,
well, thank
so,
you. And oh. Now at this point, it's just time for the mainstream media to step up and take a look at this book. I mean, people like Nancy Grace and Oprah, at least their producers, have had my book and have decided not to do anything with it. And that type of hypocrisy really bothers me. You've got Nancy Grace and Oprah. They're always harping about disadvantaged children and abused children. Well, here they have the mother of all child abuse. I mean, this was an interstate pedophile network that operated for 10 years that destroyed countless children. And they refuse to touch this book. And I just find that type of hypocrisy mind-boggling.
Well, I think, I think that they are not uninfluenced by this, the long litter of bodies along the way. And I think that...
I understand that, but... Yeah. I had to deal with that influence too. I mean, sometimes
right.
you just have to put up or shut up. And, and that's what I did. And I'd like to see some other people within the mainstream media display a similar type of courage. Because after all, the children are America's most precious resource. And if we allow them to be destroyed by pedophiles and we enable the government to cover it up, that really does not bode well for us as a country.
Right. Well, Nick, before you go, just quick tell us again your website and how we can buy the book and what else we can do to support your work going forward into getting this book out and the story out.
I am at www.franklinscandal.com. It's pretty simple to get to the website, franklinscandal.com. I'm currently working on a documentary on the Franklin scandal, and we're trying to raise funds. It's very difficult. We've gone to a number of studios, and this story, and again, I see people have just shirk their responsibility towards children. And but we are trying to raise money for a documentary. I can be contacted through the website. You can hit author, and you can shoot an email to me if you feel compelled to help us out financially and make an investment in the documentary.
Okay, well, thank you again for your work, and thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. You have a great evening.
Thank you for having me, Catherine.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I wanted to mention the next subscriber luncheon is a ways away, but it's going to be a good one. We're going to be in Nashville on December 1st. Actually, we're going to be in Murfreesboro, which is outside of Nashville, at the Five Senses restaurant. You can sign up at the blog. So if you're a Southeast subscriber, you don't want to miss it. The Solari team members, the Solari team are going to be there, Sanders family. We have all sorts of great subscribers and allies, obviously, in Tennessee. So that's going to be a special one, and you can dovetail with your Christmas shopping. Coming up next week, August 9th, we have Precious Metals Market Report, given what's going on in the market. Lots to talk about. The following week, John Rappaport and I do our second part on the best books. That's one of your big questions, what are the best books for the 21st century? And then August 23rd, very special, my partner Chuck Gibson in Sea Lane Advisory. We're doing one on the equity markets, this time the focus on technology, the view from Silicon Valley. There's a lot going on in the world of technology, and it's coming out of Silicon Valley, but it's affecting all industries globally. It's a very interesting story. Some of it is very, very positive. Some of it is very terrifying. The applications of this technology, but it's having a major influence on portions of the equity markets. If you look at those portions that have been trading well, it's very much coming from what's happening in technology. And so I want you to get a good overview and introduction to that story. So August 23rd, Equity Markets, The View from Silicon Valley. So until next week with Franklin, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.